Are you looking for a podcast that is the perfect blend of paranormal and pop culture?
Starting off with spooky stuff where we talk cryptids and ghosts.
And then we have our pop culture section where we sometimes have celebrity guests.
Whoa.
Yeah, do you want more?
Boy, howdy.
There's always genre news and all kinds of celebrity deaths. All kinds of it. If you're a celebrity and you die, we're going to talk about it.
I actually was hoping for UFOs.
Well, bet your ass we got that too at the end.
Earthling Entertainment. New episodes every Thursday.
Make sure to check us out anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Zombie Strains, the podcast that watches all the zombie movies. Today, we're discussing our second Argentine film, Strange Invasion from 1967.
No, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them, zombies or something?
Zombie.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, Mr. Bill is...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
He's a zombie.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to your favorite international zombie podcast. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
And I'm Brad.
Hi, guys. Back in Argentina for the second movie in a row. And I have to say, I started out skeptical, but actually I think this film has a couple of interesting things to say. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I had the same experience.
John, let's be honest. I think before we recorded, you weren't, the choice of words was not skeptical. I think you're a little annoyed with me for picking this.
Yes, and by little, I mean maybe a lot, and yes. however, your instincts
as a bonus
proved,
episode, right, yeah. John?
Yeah, your instincts proved true, however, Producer Brad, because this did end up being... I have a couple of things to say about this, because it is ahead of its time relative to the other things we're watching, is what I'll say. Well, everybody, let's go right to how this movie came about, Producer Brad. Let's get right into it.
Well, Strange Invasion is a 1965 Argentine film. It's also known as Stay Tuned for Terror. There's conflicting information about its release date. That's what makes you guys laugh.
That one, I don't know why that's so funny, but yes.
Clearly, that's someone in America trying to come up with a title that will be eye-catching. There's conflicting information about its release date. IMDb lists 1974. Wikipedia lists 1965. And I couldn't find any backup sources for either one, but what is certain is that the film was made in 1965.
All right.
It's our second film from Argentina and the second film to be directed by Emilio Vieira. He was an Argentine director known as Latin America's Roger Corman, since he wrote and directed low-budget horror and sexploitation films. Strange Invasion is not a sexploitation film, and I found an online review of Strange Invasion, and the reviewer, Mark Cole, thinks this is Vieira's best film, and I quote, "I suppose you have to work harder when you can't rely on naked women to sell your film."
That is as true then as it is today, Producer Brad.
Philip Kearney and Les Rendlestein wrote the screenplay. They wrote as a team and have only two writing credits, Strange Invasion and Private Parts, the 1972 film that was Paul Bartel's directorial debut. Bartel went on to direct Death Race 2000 for Roger Corman.
Oh, heck yeah.
But he is best known for his 1982 film, Eating Raoul.
Oh, okay.
Unlike our last Argentine film, The Deadly Organ, this film has two actors known to Americans.
I know, Richard Conte, out of nowhere. I'm like, we've watched some cheap movies, and this is a cheap movie, and I was like, hold on a second. I recognize that. I was just so shocked I recognized somebody.
Did you recognize his name or face?
His face.
Yeah.
I was like, I've seen that face in The Godfather. Like, I knew exactly where I'd seen that face.
Yeah. He plays Steve Jameson, the investigator from the communication department. He was in mostly crime and film noirs in the 40s and 50s, like The Spider, called Northside 777, and The Sleeping City. But as John said, he is best known for his role in The Godfather. He played Barzini, head of the Barzini crime family, and the one who goes up against Don Corleone.
Yeah.
Anna Mizrahi plays Dr. Conway. She was born in Venezuela and moved to New York in the early 60s to work at the UN. At the same time, she also started acting in off-Broadway. She moved to Los Angeles and got a few bit parts on television and in the film Riot on Sunset Strip. And in 1968, she married the famous acting coach Lee Strasberg.
Huh.
He's the one who founded the Actors Studio, one of the schools that taught method acting. And his students included Dustin Hoffman, James Dean, Al Pacino, and Marilyn Monroe.
Was it Marlon Brando, his first big Breakthrough, or was that somebody else?
Marlon Brando was part of the school as well.
Okay.
But there are a bunch of different coaches, so I'm not sure which one's Lee coach versus his wife or other teachers. Now, when Marilyn Monroe died in 1962, she left 75% of her estate to Lee Strasberg. When he died in 1982, Anna inherited control of Marilyn Monroe's estate, and she turned Marilyn into a multi-million dollar a year brand. She licensed deals with companies like Absolut Vodka and Bloomingdale's. She also sued photographers who tried to sell pictures that they took of Marilyn. She claimed she had sole legal right, and she lost these suits in 2007. And in 2011, she sold her share of Marilyn's estate to a company for over $20 million.
Huh.
And Anna is also the godmother of Drew Barrymore.
Wow.
Wow.
I know, that's a lot. For a little movie from Argentina that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
Mauricio De Ferrari plays George, the local who welcomes this disturbance in his town. He was in The Deadly Organ. He played Inspector Loria.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's why
I didn't recognize him. The quality of this film is pretty low. So, like, yeah.
I had to watch it a second time and scan through it to figure out who he was, because it's hard. Just so everyone knows, we watch on YouTube, and it's an upload from a VHS tape, so it's very poor quality.
Yeah.
So just let me get this right. You watched this a second time?
I scanned through it. I watched it and then scanned through it.
You suffer for your craft, producer Brad, and we all respect you.
Well, it's only like 57, 58 minutes, so it's not that long.
It's not the longest movie, yeah.
And I don't have much else other than several other cast members were also in The Deadly Organ and were clearly part of Vieira's entourage. Andy, do you have anything you want to add?
I have a couple of historical context bits here. Last time, we talked a good bit about the situation in Argentina in the late 60s. So if you're interested in that, you can go back and listen to that. Although I think you said this was made in 65?
Yes.
I think this came out then before the dictator Onganía took control and started his repressive rulership. Anyway, I wanted to talk about a couple of themes that were in the air that are related to this movie. So, John, what's something that people really love?
What's something? I don't know.
They love new technology.
They do love new technology.
What's something that people fear and hate?
New technology?
New technology. All right.
Have you ever heard Douglas Adams' quote about this? Because I think it's brilliant. The writer of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He said, if it came out before you were 5, it's totally natural. If it came out between the age of 15 and 35, you made a career out of it. And if it came out after you were 35, it's the devil.
So, okay, that's perfect, actually. Yeah. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about, because this is a movie about people being hypnotized into a zombie-like state by TV.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of being scared that TV was going to turn us into mindless zombies. John, what decade do you think we first started hearing concerns and complaints about the effect TV was having on children?
I want to say the early 60s.
The late 40s.
Late 40s. Interesting.
So TV is still kind of a luxury item, I think, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But by the late 40s, there were already articles starting to appear in magazines and parenting magazines questioning whether or not TV was having a bad effect on viewers. And at the time, the early critiques of TV focused kind of, they went at it from the angle that, unlike radio, TV didn't require you to use your brain. Therefore it was turning into a passive spectator, I guess. So much worse than radio or books. The 50s, though, is where I think we started to first see what you would call a moral panic about TV.
Yep.
So there's a famous guy named Dr. Frederick Wortham, who wrote a book. This was not about TV. He wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent. And John, what medium do you think he was citing as the cause of the innocence of the world being seduced.
I think I know this one. It's comic books.
Yes, yep. Exactly. But he shifted some of his focus to TV, and this is where concerns started to arise that TV was going to contribute to juvenile delinquency. And this is where you start hearing ideas that it's going to shorten attention spans and things like that. And
we know that person was right because of the WWE. Sorry, carry on.
Yes. Well, as always, so there's this moral critique of the new technology that it's going to do kind of spiritual harm to you. But because it's the 50s and there's a lot of new science coming about, and science is being incorporated more into everyday life. So this is where you did start to see doctors and educators coming out as well and questioning whether TV was going to have a negative effect on your physical health. And this is where ideas of like sedentary lifestyle, fears of that started
couch
to crop
potato.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause if you think about it, unless you were rich, it was harder to be a couch potato or until like the mid-century, I think, for most people, right?
Yep.
So by the 60s, though, this conversation is continuing to evolve. And there is a famous speech by the chairman of the FCC in 1961, where the chairman of the FCC called television, quote, a vast wasteland.
Nice.
Which is kind of funny. And he explicitly warned that mindless programming was going to affect children's minds.
You know what's fascinating about this is I think this follows as a piece from our like 1950s episode, which is a million episodes ago. But right, we now have people with a lot of free time. They have a lot of money. They don't have as much commitment in terms of work or chores. It all, I think, would feel to somebody in the late 60s like the continuing degeneration of the teenager, which is recently invented as well, right?
Like, yes.
Like definitely, you know, there's always a line that even Cicero complained about how bad the next generation was, and it's his tale as old as time, but I think this definitely feeds right into that.
So one last point here. In the 60s, the conversation took a turn that I found kind of interesting. What do you think it was about TV that freaked people out in the 60s that they thought was going to have a bad effect on your brain?
I thought they thought it was going to hurt their eyes.
Sort of. The concern, it was less about like the moral delinquency of what you were watching. Mm-hmm. And they were worried that the actual like editing format of TV, that the faster pace and loud noises and like rapid cuts were going to ruin everyone's attention spans, basically.
Interesting.
Which is a critique that, you know, I think it kind of went away and was replaced in the 70s and 80s by more of a concern about like the garbage content you were being fed on TV.
I think it came back in the 80s too with MTV because people talked about the fast-paced editing of videos and that ruining attention spans too.
And today we're talking about it with, TikTok or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So I think all three of us have had the privilege of raising kids in a digital age where we are still having variants of this conversation, right?
Yes.
Sorry for the long-winded thing there. I just thought it was kind of interesting that when this movie came out, it's clearly tapping into a conversation about what is this medium doing to us as a society, right?
Yeah, it's very thoughtful in that way, actually. But let's not give it too much credit. It's a salacious horror film about. It's not even that horrific. Anyway,
no, not really. So I have one other. If you'll indulge me, I have one other little cultural context thing. This is a little bit more has a little bit more of a tenuous connection to this movie. However, this movie is about a community, a town or a village, where something happens to everyone in the community that kind of separates it apart from the world around it in a way. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was kind of interesting. I do think this was kind of in the air at the time. The idea of stories where something bad happens to sort of a specific community of people, and the story is watching how people react under that pressure as a community, right?
Also, it seems like a similar lineage to like Village of the Damned and Children of the Damned from 1960 and 1964. It's about strange behavior of children. It's not the same because these children don't have psi powers, but it's a similar, like, our village is uniquely under attack and our children are uniquely dangerous.
You know exactly. I was going to mention Village of the Damned. And if you look in the chat, this is just fun. And listeners, please Google the poster, movie poster for Village of the Damned. I just thought it was pretty hilarious.
It is pretty great. Beware the stare that will paralyze the will of the world. I love that.
So anyway, the 60s saw a number of movies and stories along around the theme of a kind of closed-in community where something bad happens to it. There's a 1960 episode of The Twilight Zone called The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Do you guys remember that one?
No.
It's where a neighborhood is isolated, and it's been a while since I've seen it, but I think they suspect that like there's an alien invasion happening, but of course the true monster is man, right?
Right.
I think The Prisoner in 1967 is related to this genre.
Yeah.
And did you guys ever read any of Frank Herbert, the Dune guy's non-Dune novels?
I once tried to read The White Plague and I didn't make it all the way through.
Yes. Well, I didn't like that one either, but he wrote a number of short novels in like the 60s that are actually pretty enjoyable. And there's one called The Santa Roga Barrier, which is also about a town where like a kind of invisible quote dome kind of surrounds it.
Oh,
and then
also like Under the Dome by
and
one Stephen King.
King's Under yeah. the Dome much more recently. Anyway, so there's a lot of examples of this. If you go hunting there, you can go down a rabbit trail. I certainly did, but I won't belabor this anymore. So
no, that's awesome.
All right. With that said, John, we're finally ready to actually talk about this movie. So would you do the honors of doing a 60-second or a 30-second or a 10-second? however, this movie doesn't have the most elaborate of plots.
It does
a summary
not.
Of a strange invasion.
It doesn't have the most elaborate plots, but a fairly well-distilled sort of zombie-style plot. So this movie is about a small town. It could be sort of anywhere USA where a strange signal is broadcast on the TV set that hypnotizes the watchers. And as the movie goes on, more and more people get hypnotized by it. And if you try to turn off the set or take it away, the people watching it become agitated and eventually incredibly violent about being denied the feed of the TV. At the same time, those children, their parents, are becoming restless because they're worried about their children. So a sort of mob starts to form. And in the middle of this, we have investigators from out of town who are trying to solve this problem before the military can burn down the swamp and kill all the children. And our heroes have to come up with a solution to break the signal and bring the children back to life before that happens. Did I miss any big points?
You did not. And I am going to walk us through this discussion, but honestly, you kind of hit most of the big stuff that happens in this movie.
Yeah, there's somebody who's behind it that like occasionally will call the police.
All right. Well, let's start out at the beginning and I'll go over a few things that jumped out at me. You point out anything that jumped out at you, but feel free to keep us moving along. So we start out with the camera kind of pans around and we see a group of young kids that are messing around in like a junkyard, which is near a swamp. And this is going to be plot important much later in the film. But in the course of their shenanigans, I've been told I say that too much, but there you go.
No, it's great.
They knock over some barrels into the swamp. So
even though I was a kid in the 70s, producer Brad, could you imagine our parents letting us? I mean, we went and climbed around in construction sites and stuff because we lived in a neighborhood where they were building new houses. But like, can you imagine our parents if they saw us climbing on rusty barrels? Probably would have lost their minds.
Yeah.
Yes. So that is that's going to come back to haunt us much later in the film. But then we switch. The bulk of this film follows a couple of families and characters in this town. We follow one boy in particular, and he goes home. And as you do when you're a kid, you sit down to watch some TV. But John, what is different about the show that this kid is watching?
So the sort of manifestation starts as it's a regular show, but it starts to have these strange lines appear on it, as if the signal isn't clear, but the lines are consistent.
Wavy lines.
However, it starts out, I believe, as just like overlaid on the show, but it doesn't stay that way.
Yes. And so for a while, there's a number of scenes where basically people are trying to figure out, like, hey, there's something wrong with the TV.
Yes.
And so they kind of call around and they quickly discern that it's not just this one family's TV, but this is happening to a bunch of other families' TVs in the town.
Yep.
And in the course of this, we are introduced to one of our main characters. This is Dr. Sanders.
Yes.
Who's a doctor. And so here's where I should pause and say, we all watched this on YouTube, and it did not have English audio or English subtitles. So we all, at least I watched this by turning on YouTube's like auto translation subtitles.
Same here.
And let's just say it's a little rough. So it was enough to get the gist of most scenes, but there are swaths of this movie where I didn't really, I only had a marginal understanding of what was going on. So if I get some facts wrong, please correct me. But Dr. Sanders is going around, and by this time the TV interference has evolved to show a sort of hypnotic pattern.
Yes, and a few parents and other people have like tried to turn off the TV, and at first they're like, hey, go do your homework, and they'll turn off the TV, and then they'll leave, and the kid or the person will just get up and turn the TV back on. Like, that's how the resistance sort of starts.
Yes, but early on, you can kind of snap people out of this.
Right.
And when they emerge, they can't really explain what they were experiencing. We'll get into that a little bit later. We do get a little bit more details. So anyway, they hypothesize that there's some sort of local interference in or around the town that is causing this.
Yes.
And we meet when they can't figure out how to fix this or how to identify where the interference is coming from, they call in the government. So they call in what's called the Minister of Communications.
I know that sounds awfully sinister.
It really does.
Yeah, it sounds like a propaganda position, but.
Yes, it does. This is Mr. Jameson, who is one of our other main characters, and we'll actually be following him around for most of the movie. And his job is going to be, he rolls into town and he talks to Dr. Sanders, and his job is going to be basically drive around and in one case fly around and try to get a sense for like the scope of this interference.
My favorite thing about him is his name is Steve. The movie is in Spanish, and they'll be rattling on in Spanish and go, Steve. And then he's like,
and he's played by Richard Conte.
And he is Richard Conte. Yes.
So, at any rate, Steve Jameson, figures out that the interference ends about a mile outside of town. At least for now. We're going to find out later that it's starting to spread. But things are getting a little bit worse. Kids are starting to skip school and just staying home to stare at the TV. And like you said, John, when it's turned off, they as quickly as they can, they get back to a TV and turn it back on to stare at it.
Yeah, and it does happen to some adults, but not. But it's mostly children.
Yes. So the doctor thinks that this is, he kind of tells the Minister of Communication that this is a medical emergency, almost, and it's treated like a pandemic from here on out.
Yes.
So,
or would it be an epidemic? Because pandemic.
Epidemic. I'm sorry. So,
oh, wait, hold on. Do we have a John's Grammar Corner thing here? Because, when's the last time I corrected you?
Do you want Andy to lend you his theme?
Yeah, please.
Welcome to Andy's Grammar Corner.
Thank you.
All right. Correct me.
No, it's just a pandemic would be something worldwide and an epidemic would be more localized. So,
okay. Point well made. So nobody is safe, young or old. And Jameson calls the government again to report this is unlike anything he's ever seen. So he's escalating this even further up the government.
Yes.
So I kind of lost track of like who exactly was who at this point, but we were introduced to our last major character. This is Dr. Conway, and I think she's like the woman who's in charge of the government's emergency response or something. Is that
Yes. And they don't, you know, they have the classic don't take her seriously because they call her Miss Conway and she says, actually, I'm a doctor. And
Yeah, they're pretty sexist towards Dr. Conway continually throughout the
In South this. America? In 1965? What?
I know, it's hard to imagine. Yeah. Just try to imagine it. So now they get, it's getting worse. So they urge the mayor to get the town to not turn off their, to not turn on their TVs at all. We get a couple of scenes of people around town at this point. Like, so we see a scene of a family dinner. People are now like desperate to get back to their TV. So they don't want to eat or do anything else.
Yes. There's a kid that throws a fit. He's like, I don't want to eat. I want to go back to TV.
Yeah. We see a man who's like kind of frantically turning on the TV with trembling hands. Like he's shaking like an addict.
Yes. And is this the point where a lot of the kids leave their homes in the middle of the night and like break into the local TV shop and like turn on the TVs?
That's coming up in just a minute, but Let's talk about it now, because what modern movie did this remind you of, John?
What modern movie did this remind me of?
We covered it on this podcast.
Oh, Weapons.
Weapons, yes. So there's a scene where it gets so bad that kids denied their family TVs get up en masse and take to the streets and break into stores and houses where there are TVs that they can watch. But we're interrupted here because we get a phone call. The government people get a phone call from a mysterious unidentified caller. And what is his message, John?
His message is that he controls these children. This is his doing and there's nothing they can do about it. He doesn't actually state a plan, does he? Other than he just is villainous.
Yeah. Later he calls a couple times throughout the movie to kind of restate his villainous, you'll never be able to stop me. Later, he kind of criticizes the government for not negotiating with him, but he never states any demands.
I know.
So it's just kind of like, villain 101. You have to tell us what you want.
Yes. I think, and also screenwriting 101, villains have to have something to do, right?
Yeah. So this has been escalated so much now that the military show up from Washington. This is ostensibly taking place in the U.S. And the military is probing how high up into the atmosphere the interference extend. And it now is stated to be, this is a national emergency, because what they learn is that the area of interference is growing. It's spreading. So the police, and again, pop in if I'm missing any juicy scenes, John.
But no, I don't think so. I mean, one of the problems with this film is it sort of all flows together, because as you're watching it, you're watching these auto-generated subtitles that don't make very much sense. So you're trying to infer what's happening, and then you're on to the next scene. It's a bit of a muddle.
Yeah. So anyway, we're kind of barreling through this movie much faster than we usually do here, but the military escalate things even further. The police start going house to house, warning people not to use their TVs.
That's right.
And some people, though, push back. And John, why don't you tell us about, like, what is their attitude, I guess, when they bump into someone who pushes back against it?
Yeah, the most sort of, the biggest part of the scene is a character we run into. They're in a bar, and they're drinking and watching the TV, being hypnotized by it. And a policeman walks in and just turns off the TV. And immediately one of the patrons starts to give him, this guy in a black cap, that's all I can remember about him, starts giving him a hard time. And then he sort of becomes the leader of the quote unquote resistance, who is frustrated by, you know, people pushing them around. There's this paranoia or this pushback against authority in general, where they're sort of saying, hey, you can't, you elite people, you police, you can't push us around if we want to watch TV. Right. Yeah. Like it's this very interesting class. It almost goes right to like a class argument that the police shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. I found this part to be one of the more interesting moments in the movie, because he says at one point, he says, what, this is a free country.
Right.
Who are you to tell me what I can or can't watch?
That's right.
Which is kind of interesting, right? Because, I mean, kind of instinctively, we sort of side with that attitude, right?
Yeah. As Americans. I do.
At any rate, things continue to get worse, and people have now started getting violent when they are separated from the TV. So there's a scene where a kid attacks his dad.
Yes.
And he tries to turn off the TV. Everyone's sneaking out.
And while the kid is attacking the dad, dozens of kids are coming in the window at the same time.
Yes.
To get at the TV and watch. So it's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
That was a pretty creepy scene. He's getting mobbed by kids.
That was probably the most effective. Like I we can talk more about this later. The movie is not particularly scary, but that was one of the sort of effective bits.
Do you know what movie this reminds me of with these kids like this? For you, it's Weapons, but have you guys seen The Brood, the David Cronenberg?
No, that's a David, one of his I haven't seen.
It's about a woman who keeps giving, she has a womb outside her body and keeps giving birth to these kids who instantly grow up to be the same age as her own daughter. And they feed on her emotion. When she gets angry, the brood gets angry and acts on it and goes out into the town and commits violence.
Oh, wow.
That sounds pretty great, actually.
And it is David Cronenberg.
It's pretty creepy, yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess we should probably note here that the difference in like tone between this movie and the last movie we watched by the same director is quite dramatic. This movie manages to be a little creepy at points.
Yes.
But there's no violence. There's nothing salacious at all. This is a very, very tame movie compared to the one he's going to direct just a couple years later.
And like that movie, there are some artful moments to this, right? Like people in silhouette in front of a fire. Like it's not a technically terrible movie.
There's a good shot where a kid is refusing to work in his dad's shop or something.
Yeah.
And do you know what machine he's using? The camera like zooms out in a clever way from this like woodworking machine the kid's using. Did you recognize what it was? Okay. Well, the camera zooms out in an artful way from this woodworking machine the kid is using. I'm not going to rewatch this movie to try and identify what it was, but you know, listeners, if you know what it was, write in and let us know. So there's some kind of cool shots. There's a lot of shots of young people in their pajamas just walking down the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I should note here, you know, they, when they're watching the TV, they look pretty zombie-like, right?
Yeah.
They're in a total trance. They're just staring. They're not responsive. And there's something creepy, you know, people outside in the street in their pajamas is like one of those just seems wrong to us, you know? And mm-hmm. So there's some creepiness to some of these scenes. The city is now filling up with hypnotized people and concerned parents who are forming like kind of a quasi mob, right?
Yes. And they're sort of two competing, they're not competing, but the two groups that are putting pressure on the government to figure out what's going on.
All this time.
We should clarify that those who are affected by the waves are mostly children and the elderly, most susceptible. That the adults, for the most part, except for the guy in the bar, they're not affected.
That's right.
That's a good point.
You know what? And actually, one of the creepy bits or that one of the few scary things I found in here is there's an elderly person who lives at home and their TV goes off and they start yelling for somebody, but nobody comes to help them because they're all hypnotized by the TV.
Yes. So the state of the hypnotized people is getting more serious and they're starting to fall into unresponsive comas.
Yes.
It's like the condition is getting worse. It started out as like they could be snapped out of it pretty easily. And then they got uncomfortable when they were separated from the TV. Then they got violent, but now they appear to be just shutting down. And all this time we've been getting scenes of doctors and nurses kind of frantically trying to treat these people. And one of the nurses says they're addicted. It's like a drug to them.
Yes, yep.
So a riot is forming, though. That bar owner we mentioned earlier is kind of leading this riot against the authorities, who they say are overstepping their bounds. And there's some tension here because the soldiers have now... There's soldiers here, and they've kind of quarantined off this town.
Yes.
And so there's a pretty good scene where there's this line of soldiers facing this mob that's sort of surging forward, and guns come out, and, you know, are they gonna actually open fire on the villagers? You know, it's
and this is, we'll get into it in the post game, but like, we know this isn't new because we know this happened in Village of the Damned, but this idea of a local outbreak is new to us here. And I think it's an interesting trope we're going to see a lot in the future. So,
yes. So we have while this has been going on, we've also gotten one or two more phone calls from the mysterious villain who suggests that he is doing something to control this.
Despite having no plan or no demands.
Yeah, we're going to find... Well, we never really learn what his deal is, although we do find out his ultimate fate in a few minutes here. We're coming up at the end of the movie, but they have their first kind of breakthrough, I guess, and understanding what's going on.
So here I got lost, Andy, like how the pieces... There's something about the barrels, something about the swamp. And
are you saying you get lost about how the pieces come together? Because, John, they don't.
Yeah, that's right. Like, I couldn't. Yeah, that's my problem.
You guys didn't think this was a carefully choreographed chess game with all the pieces sliding into place?
My chessboard does not have enough dimensions to comprehend the complexity of this movie.
Well, what I wanted to say is something that the nurse, that Conway realizes. She realizes she's able to talk or get some information out of one of these zombie kids. And she discovers... He describes that while he was watching the TV, it felt like he was just eating an endless amount of chocolate.
He
was in a state of bliss. And so what Conway discovers is that this hypnotized state is reverting people, is trapping them in a pleasant memory or a pleasant fantasy, like to a blissful experience, or maybe even, you know, regressing them to really early childhood impulses and fantasies.
Hey,
do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Hey, producer Brad, when Andy just said that, what early 80s movie did you think of? Because I thought of a very specific one.
The Stuff?
Brainstorm.
That's on my list to rewatch. I haven't seen it since the early 80s.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it.
Let me know how that goes. No, so Brainstorm is a very early, like, VR-based movie where they invite a system that lets you... basically engage in any memory or activity you want to virtually. And people get addicted to pornography and everything else inside of this virtual machine. Anyway, so...
Well, it's also known now as the last film Natalie Wood made. She was making that film when she died. And Christopher Walken is in the film.
Yeah. And Christopher Walken, and they've got a really creepy villain who was a great villain for a few years in the 80s. I can't remember his name, but yes, it's a Christopher Walken joint before he was Christopher Walken.
Huh. Well, I'll add that to my to watch list. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah. Sorry.
But I mean, so we're getting a little bit more, you know, cultural commentary here from the movie at this point. Because what is the TVs doing? What are these doing? It's infantilizing the viewers.
That's right.
It's regressing them mentally to a very simple state, and pulling them out of the fantasy is traumatizing for these people. And so we see some, I would say, genuinely slightly upsetting shots of these people in the hospitals who are starting to almost have seizures, panicky seizures, and the longer they're separated from this blissful,
and they're
state.
All restrained to their hospital beds.
It's
they're
like
tied
withdrawal.
Down.
Yeah,
there is a kind of funny moment when they are testing this out. They have a kid in front of the TV and they have him tied to a chair like he's like a kidnapping victim or something like that. Like, it's kind of funny.
You know what? Actually, I'll make a comparison to another movie we watched. The kids are kind of like the kids in The Girl with All the Gifts, right? They have to be restrained. They're violent. They're,
yeah.
Interesting. So at this point, this is where I also started to get a little bit lost, because they start to figure out what's going on. And there's a lot of kind of incomprehensible technobabble made. I suspect it didn't make sense in the original Spanish, but it makes even less sense when you have an AI slop translation going
on. Yeah. So it's about the swamp, and I think there's contamination in the swamp from the barrels the kids were playing on.
Yes.
Which has impacted these, like, willow seeds that are going to blow into the air and infect other communities. So they've got to burn down the swamp before that happens. That's what I summarize it as.
I think that is correct.
What's missing from that summary is how the hell television is involved in any way.
Yes, or how the villain is involved in any way.
Yeah, it's like two parallel tracks of terror, but yeah, I can't quite, yeah.
So yes, as John said, so what happened, those barrels that the kids knocked over at the very beginning of the movie spilled... It spilled germanium.
No, mine said silicone on the end.
Oh yeah, it said germanium and it said silicone.
Okay.
Well, are you talking about what the AI translation said or what the barrel on screen said?
The barrel on screen said silicon.
Okay. Right. The AI translation said germanium. I don't, whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't
right.
matter.
So I think there are two different things happening, what was being spoken and what we see on screen, yes. which is part of the problem of the film.
Yes.
So anyway, whatever the substance is, it is leaked into the swamp and, you know, blah, blah, somehow this is causing this hypnotic effect on television broadcast. It makes very, very little sense.
Correct.
Anyway,
they did go on a long tangent about diathermal interference. Did you see that?
Yeah, I missed that. Sorry.
That was the part I didn't understand at all.
I had to look it up. I don't understand the science of it, but the swamp was, and the contamination of the swamp was also creating an interference in the sky that affected. Okay. So there's two things happening. The broadcast was being affected by the swamp as well as the contaminated seeds. How those two things happen at the same time, I don't know. It doesn't make sense.
That was a valiant effort, Producer Brad.
I tried.
Yeah. So that leads us to this movie's kind of the final, we're at the final climactic moments of this movie. And the final piece of tension here is the military wants to burn the swamp, which is kind of a funny thing to say.
Yes. But
like, so they're going to bring in flamethrowers and stuff and just torch the place. I thought, but our heroes are like, please don't burn the swamp. I didn't totally understand.
They were suggesting, and maybe I just made this connection in my head, is that if you cut off the source from somebody going through withdrawal, they'll like die of shock, is sort of what they were saying. And unless we can break the grip the TV has on these people, then their brains will melt, is what I sort of felt like they were inferring.
Okay. I think I like that.
But I could be making that up.
I had thought that they were worried if they set the swamp on fire, which again is kind of funny, that is what would cause the seeds to go airborne and then spread all over the place.
No, I think they were setting it on fire to prevent that. So that's why they had a deadline. But if they did it before they broke the people of their addiction to the TV, it would like fry their brains. That's how I took it. Yeah.
Well, the military agrees to give them a couple hours to fix the problem on their own, to cancel out this interference on their own before they go in and burn the swamp.
And what's interesting is this is a trope that you see still. Like I'm watching the TV show Monarch and Apple, and the heroes are trying to accomplish something, but they know the military is coming with nukes. And you better solve your problem, because if you can't, the military is going to nuke everything.
There's a movie, a Dustin Hoffman movie from the 90s, which isn't very good, called Outbreak, which has this plot explicitly. There's a bunch of infected people, and the government's like, Dustin, you have to figure out this disease, or we're going to blow up this town.
Everyone.
Yes.
So, all right. Then we get a lot of really boring scenes of Steve.
Yeah, for a tension-filled end, it's no tension.
A lot of scenes of him manipulating dials on some sort of broadcasting equipment.
While smoking. He smokes all the time.
And the tension is, can he like, there's several redundant scenes where he fiddles with stuff and it burns out the machine he's working on. Like, but at the blah, blah, blah.
They have an experiment. It almost works, but like they don't want to burn out the machinery. Yes. And then we get to the end.
But then eventually they just figure out how to do it. Right.
Yes. By turning knobs, and
he turns the knobs to the right.
Making an oscilloscope behave differently. Yes.
And it works. And everything calms down. I wrote in my notes, I'm not sure what's happening, but the mob calms down. The military burns the swamp without any ill effect because their heroes have canceled out the transmission. And our last, so I was ready to like stop watching this movie
because
I figured the credits were rolling, but we get our last like kind of remarkable little surprise out of the mob. A crazed man who is the villain who's been making these threatening phone calls, he lurches out of the crowd screaming that they're taking away his power.
Yeah.
He swears revenge, but then he jumps into the flames and is consumed. And then the movie ends with Jameson and Conway flirting and hugging.
Yeah.
But then the movie ends in a cool way by putting the last couple seconds of the film are the hypnotic interference that you're watching, like as if you are being exposed to this deadly hypnotic TV signal. And that is a wrap on Strange Invasion. And it was a little strange.
It was very strange.
An invasion, But
yeah, we don't even know what the source of all this is. I mean, what were you gonna say, producer Brad?
I was gonna say one thing I did like when the military burns the swamp, they actually have a guy with a flamethrower.
That was terrifying. That was a real flamethrower, like not some like that was like a World War II flamethrower. Yeah,
and it looked like the two lead cast members were 10 feet from the guy.
I know, he was igniting the swamp. I was like, you can't do that. Like that's not safe. Like they were actually setting stuff on fire, and it was
intense.
Yeah.
So hey, before we move into our usual wrap-up questions, anything I missed or anything you want to call out that we're not going to get to in those questions?
No, I think you did a great job of covering it and hitting the important stuff.
I think we just need to clarify that it's no way to understand what happens. It's not clear how the villains tied in with the seeds. It's almost like it's separate stories that just happen.
Yeah, I wonder if we spoke Spanish, if we could have noodled it out, but I honestly think you're probably right. That it's just not there.
Yeah. And I felt like that was a little bit more of a monologue than we usually do.
Yeah.
But this would fit comfortably into a 20-minute Twilight Zone episode.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
But instead it's like a full hour. And so this movie's problem is that it's pretty boring, honestly.
Yes. Yeah,
you get what this movie is doing about 15 minutes into it, and then you just keep getting told the same thing over and over until the credits roll.
Yes.
That said, anyway, I don't want to be too harsh on this because it was kind of interesting, but let's move into our wrap-up questions. John, in Strange Invasion, is there a hero party?
Oh, for sure. It's Dr. Conway. It is Steve. And I think the other doctor, like the nurses and doctors at the hospital, but it's really just Steve. And they sort of have this rotating cast of team members, but it's really just them.
Yes. And how do they do? How many survive?
They all survive. In fact, everybody survives except the crazy villain. Guy, the villain who jumps into the fire at the end. I was like, we hardly knew you, villain. Yeah.
Yes, at least before you go, at least tell us your plan.
Yeah, like, what was your name or anything.
Tell us how you're connected to this movie, please.
Yes.
Okay, so are there zombies in this movie? And if so, what kind of zombie are we dealing with, John?
Okay, so I am not sure even now. The kids actually, as a mob, do behave in a zombie-like fashion. They're violent, right? They break into stuff. The town is under siege, right? It feels like an infection that has to be stopped. So there are many zombie-like elements, but I don't think that they're quite zombies. I think they're just sort of hypnotized people. But if they were zombies, they would be technologically hypnotized zombies.
But let me ask you a question, John. If you had seen this movie in the context of the movies from the 30s and 40s, would they be zombies? Or are you saying they're not because you're in the 60s?
That's a great question. I'm not sure, because they are sort of mesmerized like the older zombies. And so that would make more sense. So I don't know. What do you think, Andy? This is a tough one.
This is a tough one. I do think at some point, zombie is going to mean 100% undead.
Right.
Right? Like, we have seen quite a few movies where a zombie is a living person that's just put into a trance-like state or controlled or had their will stripped away through some mechanism. At some point, I think that is going to branch off into its own thing and no longer really feel like a zombie movie.
Right.
And yeah. I think we might be around, I mean, it might be around the Night of the Living Dead, you know, that this starts, that zombie starts to mean something a little more consistent. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Actually, though, this movie, I think, has something more in common with Dawn of the Dead, but we can get to that once we get through these questions.
Sure. Okay. So how are these zombies destroyed or killed or stopped?
They're still normal humans. So you could stop them by killing them just normally, but nobody wants to because they're children.
Right. And so they can return to being human, I guess, or to a normal state.
Right.
Is the world threatened?
Yes, it is. because if this could spread to other towns, the military is worried that these seeds could spread it to other towns and could take over the whole world. They say that explicitly in the movie.
Yes. All right. So, John, at the beginning of this podcast, you laid out four pillars of the zombie movie. Let's find out how many of them are in Strange Invasion. One might end up scoring pretty well in this segment, despite being kind of an oddball movie.
Yeah.
John, in Strange Invasion, is there an apocalypse?
I'm going to say yes, there is, because people get taken over by a force outside of their control, and it's suggested it could extend beyond this little town.
Is there contagion?
No. You can get turned into a zombie, but not, another zombie doesn't turn you into a zombie.
Yes. There is something...
It's contagion adjacent.
Yes, exactly. It feels a little contagion-y.
It's close, yeah.
But it's not, yeah.
It's not person to person, it's TV to person.
Yes, exactly. And these seeds are in there somewhere, but again, it's an external source, so... Yeah, not quite.
Are there tough moral choices?
There are. The plot, the main end of the film is, how can we save these kids? We have to choose between these kids and the world. We have to burn down the swamp. How much time do we give this doctor to save these children before we have to do that? I think that's a tough moral choice.
I think so too, yes. And are there loved ones turning against you?
Yeah, because the children attack the parents who turn off the TVs, so for sure.
I think in a better movie, you know, children attacking parents is some pretty raw stuff of horror.
Mm-hmm.
It's only mildly creepy in this movie, but even in Night of the Living Dead, we're going to see that weaponized against the viewer very effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let me turn the tables on you, Andy, and ask you some questions about movies in the 60s. Does this movie feature an increase in violence or grittiness?
It does not. So this movie has essentially no serious violence in it. We see a couple of kids kind of wrestling with their parents.
Right.
That's about it. That said, any movie where it is always chilling to me, anytime, you know, you see a row of soldiers with their guns facing a crowd of civilians.
Yep.
So there's nothing gory or violent on screen, but there is that tension of violence that could break out. And, you know, seeing the military, even though they're not burning bodies or something at the end, that is kind of a classic upsetting visual to see, you know, the military flamethrowering something, right?
Yep.
So no increase in violence and grittiness, but this movie is kind of haunted by the threat of violence that I think was more on people's minds in the turbulent 60s.
I think so too. Now here's a good one. What about, do our characters question authority?
So this movie questions authority, yes. It's not our heroes so much. Well, yes, they do. So we have a couple of people questioning authority and making what I think are, you know, somewhat reasonable points. One is the locals who say, mind your own business. If we want to watch the hypnotizing TV, that's our right to do so.
Right.
Stay out of it. And then we have our own heroes who, you know, if the government swoops in and solves this, we know they'll do it in the worst overkill way possible.
Right.
So our heroes do push back against that bureaucratic government solution that will, you know, save the village by burning it down, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do we focus more on the inner life, or is there more personalized horror here?
I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
I do think the effect of the hypnotizing TV transmission, I think that reverting you to a sort of state of infantilization is kind of interesting, but it's not really personal. And honestly, none of these characters are deep enough to even, I mean, these are all characters that can be described in one sentence.
Yeah. And it's really that kid reflecting on how it's like eating chocolate all the time is the closest we get to that in this.
Yes.
Movie. Yeah. How about a fear of crime, societal chaos, or anarchy?
So yes, I think this movie is toying with this, with its scenes of angry people in the streets and, you know, facing down a row of gun wielding soldiers.
Yep.
we don't see sort of the breakdown with, like, you know, looting and violence in the streets and Molotov cocktails and stuff that you might see in later movies that do this sort of thing.
No, but you do see zombie children breaking into people's homes.
That's, yes, you do. So, you know, these are, you know, are these the youthful delinquents of the 60s that are watching too much TV and now they're loose in the street breaking store windows? Maybe. So we'll give this one a yes.
All right. Is there a looming sense of apocalypse and psychological stress?
So I think, you know, the threat that this is going to go global is kind of looming in the background of this movie. The movie isn't executed in a way that fear ever feels terribly real to you, the viewer, but it is technically there. At one point, the villain calls in and he, although we now know that the villain has only a marginal connection to what's going on, the villain says the end is near, as if he knows that all of this is building up. As the hypnotized people's symptoms worsen, it does seem to be leading up to something that fortunately the world never has to see, right?
That's right. Now, are there horrors without solutions or lack of clear villains to defeat? And let me caveat this question by saying, just because the film is incompetent doesn't mean it gets a yes on this. Just because the plan is unclear doesn't mean it's an automatic yes.
Right, yes. So I think this is also a yes. This is, first of all, the villain they defeat, you know, doesn't really, again, this might be a filmmaking competence thing, but it's not clear that the villain really was the villain. I mean, he could just be a deluded person.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't even know if he wants anything.
Right. So I do think, you know, in the sense that this movie is about the fear of this new technology and these new ideas and mediums that our kids are absorbing, goes well beyond something that can be solved by just defeating the enemy or cleaning up this one spot of spilled silicon or whatever the chemical is.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right. Well, do you want to bring this horse back into the barn here, Andy?
I do indeed. We always close with three traditional questions. First, John, would you and I survive in the zombie world of Strange Invasion?
I think so, because most people survive.
Yeah.
Yeah. We might get hypnotized. We might become an angry mob. We might get punched by a doctor. But on the whole, nobody really dies, except for a couple people.
We're both firmly in middle age. Do you think that we are old enough to be, you know, as Brad pointed out earlier, the window of vulnerability is being young or being old? Do you think we get glued to our TVs and hypnotized, John?
I don't think I do that anymore. I used to. I get glued to YouTube. Does that count?
Yes.
it does.
Okay.
Yes.
Then yes.
It 100% counts. Or would you be in the streets yelling about the government trying to stop you from watching TV or something like that?
I'd like to think so.
Okay. Right. You're a good all-American guy.
That's
all right. John, is this a zombie movie or a movie with zombies?
I'm going to say it's actually, and I don't think I would have answered this when we started this conversation, I'm going to say it's a zombie movie because it does have zombie things to say, even if technically I'm not sure they're zombies.
I also have, I'm going to say yes, and I have been moved to say yes by this discussion. I think going into this discussion, I was planning to say this was like a movie without zombies.
Yes. All right.
All right. Lastly, John, do you recommend this movie? First, just generally as something that's worth watching. And secondly, does this have special interest for our zombie loving listeners?
So I'll do what I've been doing lately, which is take the second question first. There's something really interesting about this movie that I wasn't expecting to see yet. This is a piece of social commentary about the impact of a new technology or a new cultural wave on a society that is more in line with Dawn of the Dead and its theme about consumerism, right? And the sort of shallowness of modern American culture. And we haven't had a movie do that yet. So that is really interesting to me, that we're there well before I thought we'd be there. However, the quality, the difficulty in watching it, and the fact that I'm not quite sure they're zombies, I don't think I can I think there's a couple of interesting pieces here, but I don't think I can recommend it in either case, ultimately. If we had a clean copy with clean English subtitles or an English dub that we could recommend to people, I might say yes, but I don't think I can in the current environment.
Yeah, I mean, I would just second everything you said. This is a pretty boring movie, I thought, with some surprisingly interesting themes.
Yes.
That will become part and parcel of the zombie genre in future years, but is kind of, I guess I didn't expect them to crop up in this weird little niche film.
Yeah, I was surprised. It took a big swing, and I think it technically couldn't, you know, match. Its eyes were too big for its stomach, but it certainly tried, I think, to say yes. Something interesting.
Well put. All right. Well, that means it's time for the scariest part of the episode, and that is when producer Brad reveals to me and John what zombie movie we'll be watching next.
And if we actually got closer to Night of the Living Dead, or if he's found some other South American delights to put in our way.
There are other continents we haven't visited.
Oh, dear.
Hold your tongue.
Oh, boy. Okay. Give it to us.
So I will play you a clip from the trailer for this film.
I'm listening.
And then we will see the poster. So right. First up, here's the trailer.
Terror stalks the streets as a scientist's human transplantation experiment runs amok. The Astro Zombies.
Nice.
It is done, Francho.
John Carradine and Wendell Corey star in one of the most frightening horror films ever made. Watch in terror, scream in fright, thrill to breathless excitement as these skull-faced astro-zombies strike blindly at living flesh, tearing, ripping, and killing with blood-drenched fury. Unbearable suspense and sadistic terror grip the senses as these human transplants threaten the safety of a city.
This is a very delicate situation. We are concerned with the mutilation murders that have occurred over the past 6 months.
The beautiful, voluptuous, deadly, vicious Satana, a woman who would stop at nothing to gain control over the astro zombies, whose creed was kill, kill, kill.
Huh. This movie, that trailer kept ramping up the volume.
This is all over the place. First of all, I like to state for the record that I am no relation to the Wendell Corey who stars in this film, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, how do you know, John?
I don't know. Maybe I should look it up. But John Carradine again, I mean, you got to give it a shot if John's in it. You know what I mean?
So here's the poster.
You love there's always a certain try hard vibe to these trailers that like insist on how scary and terrifying the movie is going to be. I will say this is over the years we've seen movie posters get a little bit more lurid and risque. This is our most grotesque poster yet, I think. You want to describe it, John?
Yeah, it looks like it's drawn by maybe a middle schooler who's really into heavy metal. Yeah. It says, dismembered bodies, transplanted organs are used to create astro zombies. I have to ask if this is the original poster because it's so weird, but we see like a tattooed woman and a zombie like with a woman in its mouth holding up a severed screaming woman's head, and it's green and red and all primary colors, and it looks like a cartoon.
It does look like a modern poster drawn for campy retro appeal,
yes,
doesn't it?
It has that vibe.
That said, I would be delighted to learn this is original.
It's listed as a theatrical release poster from 1968.
Amazing. Okay.
All right.
Your parents would not have let you watch this, I think, John.
No, I don't think so.
On the basis of this poster.
All right. Well, I'm here for it. What's the countdown, Brad? How many films remain? Say it again.
So we have two. We had another one in here, but it's a film that has multiple release dates and multiple cuts and multiple edits. So the version we're going to watch is from the 70s, so I pushed it.
Okay. So that means, so hold on. We have Astro Zombies, one other movie, and then we're at Night of the Living Dead? Okay.
Is this the first time Brad has stricken a film from the list? Because he keeps finding ones to add.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, this is the first time we've had a countdown where I've had to acknowledge my mistakes. Usually I can just escape by and not tell anyone.
Also, I would like to say he's not cutting it from the list. He's just moving it in the schedule.
That's
so.
A good
Well, we have to. It has John Carradine as well. So.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can email us at zombiestrainspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your questions or thoughts. Follow us on social media. We're Zombie Strains on Instagram. And we hope to hear from you there. In any case, join us next episode for Astro Zombies. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.